It's good that, so I mean, one of the ingenious things about this multifaceted approach to Bitcoin is that people owning Bitcoin in the US as a speculative investment is actually helping people in other countries to resist authoritarianism. And I think that's kind of cool.
Welcome again to the Abundant Minds podcast. Today we're joined by Brad Rettler. He's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Wyoming and the director of the University of Wyoming Bitcoin Research Institute. Brad holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Notre Dame and is a senior fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. He also just co-authored the book Resistance Money, which we got here. So congratulations, Brad, on your new book, and welcome onto the podcast. How are you, man?
Thank you. Doing great. Good to be here. Thanks for buying the book.
Of course. Well, we start off asking everybody that comes on the podcast, how did you get into Bitcoin and kind of what was your road into Bitcoin? Was it from your philosophy background, or could you tell us a little bit about that early story for you?
Sure. It was summer of 2013, just about to start my last year in graduate school. And this guy, like, we would go out to the bars all the time towards the end of the day and talk about philosophy. And that's how you sort of hone your ideas. And there was one guy who was particularly pugnacious when it came to discussions and just always wanted to fight and always wanted to argue. He'd ask you what you were working on, and then he would try to tear it apart as best he could. And it was great because it helps your ideas get better. So we come back from the summer. I've written a bunch of stuff, and I'm looking forward to, you know, pitching it to him and seeing what he thinks, where the weak points are. And all he wanted to do was talk about Bitcoin. He had spent the entire summer researching this thing, and he was fascinated by it. And so he didn't want to talk really about philosophy anymore. He just wanted to talk about Bitcoin. And I didn't really get it, but he sort of like forced us to. Anyone who wanted to talk to him, you'd have to at least get some of it. And I don't think I understood sort of the idea that it wasn't backed by anything, wasn't backed by dollars. I don't think I really understood the supply cap. But what I did understand was the immutable blockchain and the ability to transfer value internationally, digitally, for, like, at the time, a few pennies. That was on-chain transactions were a few pennies at the time. And I was like, this is going to revolutionize international remittances and international payments and stuff. So it's something I should pay attention to. So that's what got me started, was understanding this one particular aspect and seeing how that was important. And I find it really interesting because everyone, you know, obviously you ask this question of everyone, they all have different ways into Bitcoin and probably different aspects of Bitcoin that attract them. For a lot of people, it's this supply-capped gold-like currency. For me, it was the digital cash-like stuff.
Very cool. You know, I totally agree with you. Everybody's kind of got their own little keystone, their own way in. Do you think that Bitcoin is a natural fit for the people who are interested in philosophy?
I think so. Yeah. Philosophy is, you know, wide ranging and almost it's its own discipline, but it's also interdisciplinary in a way. We try to tell other disciplines what to do. We make evaluative claims about what they're doing. So you've got philosophy of economics and philosophy of technology and philosophy of law. And these are all areas that touch on Bitcoin or that Bitcoin touches on. So I think for people that are interested in this kind of multifaceted phenomenon, Bitcoin is endlessly rewarding because there's always something new to think about. And then the interplay between that new thing and everything else that's going on. Now, recently, obviously, political science is entering into it. But yeah, I think people with a philosophical bent, if they went just a little ways down the rabbit hole, would find themselves going much further. Now, as a matter of fact, I think a lot of people have already made up their minds without knowing very much, and I think that's unfortunate. But hopefully this book can do a little bit, at least, to try to help them understand that there's more to it than what they've heard.
If you were to describe what the philosophy of Bitcoin is, and I know that could take us hours, days, or weeks, and we'd never even touch it, how would you summarize the philosophy of Bitcoin?
I don't know if Bitcoin itself has a philosophy. So I think that there are classic philosophical issues that are relevant to Bitcoin and that Bitcoin touches on. So one of the ones that sort of started off the whole resistance money journey and the idea that we could think about Bitcoin through a philosophical lens was the paper Craig Warmke, one of my co-authors, published in Inquiry called What is Bitcoin? And what is blank is a very standard philosophical question in metaphysics. You ask, like, what are properties? What is time? What is space? What are material objects? So Craig asked, what is Bitcoin? And then he does it through a very standard metaphysics sort of lens. What kind of thing is this? Is it a natural kind or is it a social kind? Natural kinds are kinds that would exist even if there weren't people around to think about them and name them and use them. Things like cows. Cows would still exist if there weren't people, and cows would naturally go with each other more than any cow would go with, like, a wolf or a rock or something. But then there are these social kinds that plausibly wouldn't have even begun to exist if people weren't around. And I think money is one of those things. And so if Bitcoin is money, then Bitcoin is also one of these things. But these are really important. Like, plausibly race and gender are two of them. And race and gender turn out to be really important to people's self-conception and identity and interactions in the world and how they get around. So it's not to say when you say something is a social kind that it's not important. So... yeah, that's one classic philosophical question that comes up when thinking about Bitcoin in metaphysics. Then there's really interesting questions in epistemology, and we were going to do, Andrew and I, one of my other co-authors, or my only other co-author, we're going to do a special issue on philosophy of technology, and the person who is going to write the leading article is going to write it on the effects on epistemology of blockchains. So how does blockchain change knowledge, or how you come to knowledge, or evidence, or justification for your beliefs? And it's really interesting because of the mechanisms by which blockchains can be changed. And then obviously there's all these ethical questions that come up, both relating to the things internal to Bitcoin, like, is the method of distributing coins fair, just, equitable, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But also then the externalities. Take all the good things that Bitcoin brings about. Are there any bad things that are come about as a result of Bitcoin? Not necessarily internal to the Bitcoin system, but because of how it's been worked out in the world. Maybe things like carbon emissions. And then how do you weigh that against all the good things that Bitcoin has done? Maybe good things that couldn't have been gotten without the carbon emissions. Maybe good things that could have been gotten without the carbon emissions, but weren't. You know, you have a bunch of classic areas in philosophy. Metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics are three of them. And I think Bitcoin is interesting with respect to all of them.
I would totally agree with you. And that actually leads really well into a chapter that's in the book, which I really enjoyed. That's, I think it's called Behind the Veil. And you guys go through a thought experiment of, you know, whether Bitcoin is a net positive or negative, depending on who you come into the world as. And it takes you through, I think, a Silicon Valley tech CEO, a female Afghan entrepreneur, and several other different kinds of people that you could potentially incarnate into and take it through the theory of, you know, depending on who you come into the world as, is Bitcoin a net positive, a net negative? Does it really make no difference? How would you evaluate from a philosophical perspective whether Bitcoin has a net positive or negative impact, and even how do you compare a world that we have Bitcoin in and a world that we don't have Bitcoin in?
Yeah, great question. The key thought behind the veil of ignorance is to kind of get you out of your own biases, your own frameworks for thinking about things. And one of the helpful ways to do that is to imagine you could be anyone and then ask what choice you would make in that world. It's even hard to evaluate, you know, is Bitcoin good for this person? Is Bitcoin good for that person? But it's relatively easy to think, if I were that person, would I choose a world with Bitcoin or a world without Bitcoin? What would my life look like without Bitcoin? And there, I think a lot of people would pretty obviously choose to be in a Bitcoin world because they're people that can be benefited by Bitcoin. In some cases, people whose lives might be saved by Bitcoin. So if you get enough of these people where they would choose the Bitcoin world, then it's kind of, I don't know, parochial or patronizing or whatever, to make the opposite choice for them, that they would to try to work for the destruction of something that they would choose. And you know, you yourself would choose it if you were them. And of course, just because you're not them doesn't mean that nobody is them. They still exist whether or not you actually can be them. So there's a lot of people who we need to evaluate Bitcoin from the perspective of. And then they might look at things like carbon emissions of mining in Kazakhstan and say, that's bad, but it would be worse if I didn't have access to Bitcoin, because then I couldn't feed my family, or then I couldn't protest my authoritarian government, or I couldn't secure my life savings as I flee this country that's persecuting me. So I'm willing to deal with the effects of burning coal to mine Bitcoin if it means I can get this life-saving good for myself. So we don't necessarily tell people how to evaluate these things. We just tell them what's at stake for people. Mm. We expose the stories that, for example, Alex Gladstein tells, and Roya Maboub tells, and Alexei Navalny and the Open Dialogue Foundation tell. And we say, here are people that we should trust to tell us the truth about their own experiences, and here are their experiences with Bitcoin. If you want to ban Bitcoin or try to get rid of it or try to take down the network, these are the people that you're harming, and these are the ways in which you're harming them. So go into it with your eyes open if that's really what you want. Or maybe, hopefully, you don't know these stories and you're only focusing on one small aspect of Bitcoin. But it turns out there's a lot of competing concerns that go into a full evaluation of Bitcoin.
So for many of those circumstances or those kinds of lives that we could be incarnated into, the key differentiator is that Bitcoin is resistance money. It's resisting some other form of control. Could you talk a little bit about what it means for something to be resistance money, or maybe define resistance money?
Sure. We think about money as involving three roles. So one role is the maker of the money, one role is the manager of the money, and one role is the mediator of the money. So makers are the ones who make decisions about how much money there's going to be, how it gets introduced into the world, who gets it, how it gets taken out, whether it's destroyed or not, how much of it, all those kinds of things. Managers are ones who hold on to the money for you. So think here of the makers are central banks. The managers are some central banks, but also commercial banks, and perhaps yourself. If you withdraw cash and then, you know, put it in your sock drawer or in a safety deposit box or something, you're managing it yourself. And then mediators are people that enable transactions between people. So in some cases of US dollar transactions, there is no mediator. You know, I give someone a $5 bill, they give me some food, the transaction's over. But in a lot of cases, there are mediators. That could be PayPal, Venmo, it could be a commercial bank in the case of like a mortgage or something like that, Visa, MasterCard, and so on. Bitcoin is a way to resist all of these three roles. It's a way to resist specifically authoritarians in those roles. So authoritarians as makers are people who hoard the money supply for themselves or for their friends, who behave irresponsibly with respect to it. They issue too much money or not enough. So they could either be unintelligent and make bad decisions, or they could be intelligent but selfish, morally corrupt. In either case, you end up with bad money creation. Similarly with managers, you get people who in positions of authority where they have control over your money, and they get to decide whether or not you can have it. If you've ever tried to go into a bank to withdraw $20,000 of cash, you know that it's not really yours. It might have your name on it, but it's up to someone else whether you get to have it that day or not. Mm-hmm. And similarly, it's up to somebody else whether they will allow you to continue to have it managed by them. So they have discretion and they can stop managing your money at any time and say, we're no longer interested in this relationship. And then the same thing with mediators. Mediators can cut you off. They can cut off the person you're trying to pay to. They can cut off certain kinds of transactions. you know, Visa might say, even though it's legal in the state of Colorado, we are not going to process any sales of marijuana in this state, period. They could do it for sex work. They could do it for gender-affirming drugs, firearms, abortions, anything they want. So that's a problem because money is how people flourish. It's how people get the goods that they need to have the life that they want to have. And it turns out that they're not in very much control over that. It doesn't maybe seem like they're not in control as long as they're living the kinds of lives that the people in charge want them to live. But the second you try to do something that people in charge don't want you to do, you find out that you don't really have as much control as you thought. So Bitcoin has no centralized makers. The making of Bitcoin is governed by an algorithm, and the distribution of that Bitcoin as it's made is governed by the same algorithm. Bitcoin does not require mediators. At best, miners are mediators, but you have a sort of rotating cast of mediators, and they don't know who they're mediating transactions between because they only have access to addresses, not identities. And you can, if you choose to, manage the Bitcoin yourself, whereas it's completely irresponsible to hold $100,000 worth of cash at your house. It's not completely irresponsible to hold $100,000 worth of Bitcoin in some multi-sig account that you have two of the three keys for that are geographically distributed or something like that. So Bitcoin does away with the need to trust makers, mediators, and managers. And in some cases, like in the case of makers, completely removes the possibility of tampering, irresponsibility, unintelligence, and so on.
So you talked about everything has externalities, right, that are unintended consequences. And there's a whole class of people, maybe uninformed people, who would rather have the externalities of control and inflation versus, say, the externalities of mining and its energy use. And we, you know, as a mining company, of course, we deal with the whole spectrum of people and their opinions on mining. How would you compare the externalities of Bitcoin mining to, say, those others that come with the current system with fiat currencies?
Compare the externalities of the Bitcoin system, which involves mining, versus the externalities of the dollar system, which involves... Okay, so it's hard to know what all is involved in the dollar system that would go away if the dollar system went away. For example, would we no longer have armies? Armies, turns out, use a lot of energy. And they don't necessarily strive for the cleanest energy because, you know, time is of the essence very often. So we have a system that involves creating very large weapons and then using those weapons and harming a lot of people and harming the environment in the process. So does that go away without the US dollar? How much of this is actually spent securing the dollar? I'm not sure. Certainly some of it. We also have an entire central bank and commercial banking system that not only involves climate. So maybe let's take a step back. We have climate externalities for these other things as well. We have climate externalities for Bitcoin mining. We have climate externalities for fiat currencies. Then we have other kinds of externalities for both systems as well. So we have externalities like redlining in the U.S., which was the process of denying commercial banks denying home loans for people who wanted to buy houses in certain geographical areas and denying home loans to people based on the color of their skin. That is an externality of the current financial and monetary system. If loans were given in Bitcoin, would these things have occurred? Maybe. I don't know. They wouldn't have to, right? You don't have to go into a bank to get Bitcoin loaned to you, but you do have to have some sort of collateral if you want to get a loan. So it's just hard to know when we're weighing things like this against each other, what to include on each side. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is that very often people include nothing on the positive externalities of Bitcoin side, and they include nothing on the negative externality sides of fiat currencies. And they say, look, Bitcoin mining is causing carbon emissions. That's bad. We should get rid of Bitcoin. And that just is like a completely unbalanced equation. And so the goal in the book is not necessarily, again, to carry out the evaluation, but to begin to make people aware of the fact that you have to compare Bitcoin against something. The something that you're comparing it to doesn't have zero negative externalities. And then in some cases, it's just a whole lot easier to figure out what the externalities of Bitcoin are because it's a much more transparent system. We know roughly exactly how many miners there are because we know exactly what the hash rate is at any given time. We know roughly what percentage of Bitcoin energy use is renewables versus coal versus natural gas. We know exactly how much Bitcoin there is, so we can figure out how much is being spent to secure how much value. And all these things are just really well hidden in the fiat currency system. We don't know how much money there is out there. We don't know how much energy is being used to secure it. We don't know what methods of security are necessary. In the book, when we talk about security, we point out all the waste that's happening at Fort Knox to guard this gold, because none of the Secret Service agents who are guarding Fort Knox have ever had to fire their weapon. They're just like walking around opening doors, and we're paying them all this money, and they're consuming all this food. They could be productive members of society, but they're not doing anything. They're just walking around. Obviously, that's a ridiculous way to look at the security of Fort Knox, because they serve as a deterrence. And that's exactly what miners do for Bitcoin. They serve as a deterrence against people who would try to attack the network, because the only way to attack the network is to marshal some computing power against it. And when you're considering doing that and you look at this massive wall of computing power that's being used in service of it, honestly, you think, this isn't worth it. I'm not going to try. And that's exactly what you do when you're evaluating whether or not you should try to steal the gold out of Fort Knox. You look at all the Secret Service agents and you're like, it's not worth it. It's likely not going to work, and it would cost us more. And you do the cost-benefit analysis, the expected utility, and it's just not worth attacking. And this is exactly what Satoshi saw with mining, right? He or she wanted it to always be the case that the expected utility of marshaling that computing power in service of the network, honestly, would outweigh the expected utility of trying to attack the network. And so far, it seems that's exactly what's happened.
Do you think, because you mentioned that mining uses a lot of renewables, there is still coal and natural gas and all of these different energy sources on the network. Is there a balanced way to look at what the mining network should aspire to use as an energy source? Or do you think that because of the positive externalities to, like you mentioned, people escaping autocratic regimes, that it doesn't matter what energy source it uses, just so long as it provides the net benefit to people who are trying to use it as resistance money? Is there a way that we can approach this openly and honestly?
I think there's a couple different ways to approach it. So one way is just the free market way. As long as there are miners that are willing to use a certain kind of energy, then it obviously, the market is deciding that it's worth using that kind of energy for this kind of purpose. And so rather than thinking of it as something to aspire to, you think about it as what it's worth to the people who are using it. The other way is to just think that because Bitcoin mining is so interesting with respect to energy use, things are just going to work out the way that they have to. And Bitcoin is interesting with respect to energy use because it's completely location agnostic. All you need is access to a satellite that allows you to download a couple of megabytes every 10 minutes and upload a little bit every once in a while. So you could basically do this anywhere. Unlike things that need to be tied to grids or need to be close to population centers or something like that. So every little bit of energy that is being wasted right now in the world, whether it's energy that's being created and then wasted, like through solar or wind farms or something like that, or whether it's just untapped energy, like geothermal or tidal or something like that, all of that could be used to mine Bitcoin. And at some point, I think it will be. there's no reason not to use this extra energy to mine Bitcoin. And the more energy that's being used in service of Bitcoin mining, the less it makes sense to pay anything at all for energy to mine Bitcoin. So the less it makes sense to use natural gas or coal or anything that's not already free. So you might think that the end state of Bitcoin mining that we're moving towards is one where it is 100% either renewable or waste, or it's getting incentivized in some way. So I think one of the things we're seeing in Texas, and maybe we'll come to other places, is that they want to overproduce energy almost all the time, because every once in a while they have these freak climate events where they need a lot of energy all at once. And they want to be able to produce that much energy when it's needed. But if they produce it all the time, they're mostly wasting it. Unless they have this person who will use the energy, pay for it a little bit, and then turn off in times of need. So that might be one area where we see non-renewables continue to be used, is because it's so important to the stability of the grid or to these times of peak need. In general, I think people should try to use renewable energy when they can for everything. But it's not so simple as, you know, we should stop doing all this other stuff and just start mining using renewables. And then, as you were alluding to towards the end of your question, even if Bitcoin wasn't using as much renewable energy as it is, that doesn't automatically mean that it's bad. We still have to weigh it against these other things. So maybe instead of lobbying for Bitcoin to change the code, Greenpeace should be lobbying for Bitcoin to find more sources of renewable energy and incentivize renewable energy build-out. That seems to me like it would be a much more productive campaign anyway, because all of the people who recognize the positive externalities of Bitcoin might still recognize the negative externalities. And all the people who recognize the positive externalities of proof of work will still think, yeah, there's a better way that we could do this.
I think that's a really balanced way to approach it. And, you know, obviously you wrote a Bitcoin book, we run a Bitcoin mining company. It's really hard to remove our biases, but one thing I really appreciate about Resistance Money, the book, is that you guys do a really effective job at trying to take away the lenses that come from your biases and really answer the questions of, is Bitcoin good? You know, what would a world without Bitcoin look like, in a way that does not come from a place of, you know, my livelihood depends on this thing existing. I don't necessarily know that that's been the same in traditional academia. Do you feel like Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining gets a fair treatment, or do you feel like there's still a lot of bias that circulates in other publications?
Absolutely the second thing. So one of the reasons that we started the Bitcoin Research Institute is because as we were writing Resistance Money, we're looking at the academic literature. It's an academic book. I'll say both my parents have read it. They are not academics. We very much tried to keep in mind this. We want this to be a book that you can hand, that could be the first Bitcoin book you hand to someone. So we're not writing to philosophers, but we are writing as philosophers. So, and what we do is we look at the literature. And what we found in the literature was really distressing, because people are writing about this phenomenon without understanding all of the aspects of it. And not only are there many aspects of it, but they're tied together in some really interesting ways. And sometimes I discover new insights that Satoshi had when creating this. I remember at one point early on when we were talking about the network, we were like, it seems really kind of wasteful, not the proof of work system, but to create this hash that you don't ever use again. You find this nonce and then you don't ever use it again. And it turns out you do use it again, because that's what orders block headers. And so there's like reusable aspects of this thing that just indicate how elegantly it's designed. And so when people miss aspects of the Bitcoin system, it gets frustrating. And then when those are published in one case, the journal Nature Climate Change, which is a Nature journal, which is a really big deal in the sciences, it gets extra frustrating, because you know people are reading this journal and that they're taking this as fact. They know less than the people who are writing the papers. So, you know, obviously the shining example, if you take shining to be a bad thing in this case, is the Mora et al. Paper Bitcoin alone could increase global climate by 2 degrees by 2020 or something like that. And what Mora et al. Did was they plotted the adoption of Bitcoin, and they said if Bitcoin adoption increases at a certain rate, then transactions are going to increase at the same rate. And if transactions increase at the same rate, then mining is going to increase at the same rate. And given the mixture of energy use, that much more mining will cause this much more climate change. So anyone who knows anything at all about Bitcoin knows that you can't increase transactions beyond a certain amount. The system is self-regulating in this way, that if too many people try to put in transactions, the mempool gets loaded up, you have to pay more for transactions, and this is why transaction fees go up. But Bitcoin blocks have a size cap, and that you just can't go over them. Not only that, but they can't come faster and faster. We have a built-in difficulty adjustment. So miners have to expend more energy to do the same thing, which is publish one block every 10 minutes. So at a certain point, it's not worth expending that much more energy unless the price of Bitcoin. So there's this whole complicated system going on that Mora et al. Just doesn't even understand and doesn't take into account. So this is obviously the most egregious example of a Bitcoin paper not understanding Bitcoin. But the thing has like 500 citations at this point. And it's out there. And people know it. And it's still being cited. So it's not the only one, right? A lot of publications about Bitcoin don't understand the difficulty adjustment, or don't understand the supply cap, or don't understand the difference between intrinsic value and extrinsic value, value that something has by the nature of what it is versus the value that something has because of how you can use it. Some of them don't understand off-grid mining. So there's just all sorts of mistakes that people make because they're not incentivized to get it right. And so the hope with the Bitcoin Research Institute, at least, is that people do want to get it right, and people who like Bitcoin or who understand Bitcoin, who are students or faculty members, want to be working on it, but they're not incentivized to do that. They might work in some field that's related to Bitcoin, and they might be interested in Bitcoin for other reasons, and their current academic community wouldn't reward, or might even, they might get ostracized for saying positive things about Bitcoin. So the goal of the Bitcoin Research Institute is twofold. One, it's to provide a place where Mora et al. Can come present a paper and someone can say, have you heard of the difficulty adjustment? And then the project can get scrapped or can get more accurate data. And instead of Bitcoin alone could push global climate change 2 degrees, it might be 0.02 degrees or something. But at least the data would be accurate. And then the other thing is to provide a place for people who aren't publishing about Bitcoin but want to have a community and to do projects together with people in that community.
So in the process of doing your research for the book, I mean, you had to go deep into the writings of Satoshi himself or herself. You had to go, obviously, look at many of these other papers. Was there anything really surprising or insightful that you uncovered for yourself that really evolved your understanding past what you had coming into the writing of the book?
That's a good question. It was such a long process that it's kind of hard to go back to the moments beforehand. And so many of the things I learned just in conversation from Andrew and Craig, I think that we were each important in how the book came out. And I think one of my biggest roles was in kind of dumbing down the things that they were saying. I think they understand all this stuff, the entire cryptocurrency ecosystem, and then the code and all those sorts of things better than I do. And so because of that, I was able to say, people aren't going to understand this. Let's write it this way. They could explain it to me. And in so doing, we could figure out how to explain it to everyone else. So I learned a ton just from talking to them. I guess one of the really interesting things, I had a really long conversation with Will Luther, who's an economist at Florida Atlantic University, about volatility. And at one point we had in the book that, you know, Bitcoin is undergoing this discovery period, and at a certain point, everyone who wants Bitcoin is going to have it, and everyone who doesn't have it isn't going to want it, and then Bitcoin will be stable. And Will is like, no way. demand for dollars isn't stable right now, and you have to have them to pay taxes and stuff. So demand is always going to fluctuate. And with other things, supply can fluctuate in response. So you can get stability of purchasing power or value or whatever. But Bitcoin has no ability to alter supply in relation to demand. So given that demand will always fluctuate and supply will not, Bitcoin is always going to be volatile. This is a critique of Bitcoin that will continue forever, potentially. And of course, the volatility might go down. But I had to really rethink how to respond to the argument that Bitcoin is too volatile to serve as money. It's not enough to say, well, someday it won't be volatile, because it probably will forever. So yeah, I learned a lot about that. I learned a lot about how mining works, and I learned a lot about other validation systems. So obviously proof of stake, but other ones that have been proposed, proof of burn, proof of space and time, all these other things. Because, right, Bitcoin could, with a hard fork, switch to any of these. And it's worth thinking about why that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing. I'm an academic researcher. I came into this thinking that Bitcoin was probably good, but being open to the fact that it might not be. It might be that the result of this study would tell me I actually need to go all in on Monero, or I need to go all in on ETH, or I need to be completely anti all cryptocurrencies and try to reform central banks in some other way, or start thinking that central banks are excellent and doing great. So yeah, I came into it open to being proven wrong about my hunches about Bitcoin. And as the evidence stacked up, right, there were some things that made me less positive about Bitcoin. But for me, the more you hear the stories of the people who are using Bitcoin as a way to resist authoritarians, the more you think they need something like this. And that outweighs a whole lot of negatives for me.
I think, you know, a lot of people, myself included, probably you as well, first came into our study and understanding of Bitcoin with a lot of misconceptions, or just no conception at all. And you mentioned that your role in some sense was dumbing down the book, or maybe simplifying it for a broader audience. Did you find any analogies or metaphors or really useful ways of explaining it to someone who, you know, as a philosopher, I'm sure you get this a lot, as coders and engineers and miners, we get this a lot as well. We keep everything very heady and tough to understand, but really we're alienating an entire class of people that are never going to do that kind of rigorous cognitive work. So are there any kind of understanding tools that you've developed, or that you've, practiced more through this process, that you found especially useful in getting people who wouldn't necessarily approach this with that same kind of caloric intensity in their brain that you would?
Yeah, all analogies fall short, right? So it's just a question of how willing are you to get some of the details wrong in order to help people understand it. So I really like to explain the Bitcoin network as like email addresses that are just gobbledygook, let's say gobbledygook at bitcoin.com. And the only thing, the only emails that you can send have numbers, and they have to be positive numbers. And every email account has like a balance. And the only way to get a balance in your email account is for someone to send you an email with a positive number. And of course, they have to have a balance in there in order to be able to send it to you. And so you could get that positive balance by like doing some work for someone, then they send you an email. Or you could do it by helping the email servers to be like resistant to attacks. And so imagine Bitcoin like this, where you're just doing numbers, and then imagine people were willing to trade you apples and bananas and moving, you know, you help them move, they'd send you a number. eventually maybe you get enough that you could actually send someone a number and get their house. That's kind of like how Bitcoin works. It misses all the stuff about mining, and it misses the fact that addresses don't have balances, and you shouldn't reuse addresses and all that. But it gets at an important thing, which is that you're just like publishing transactions. So you have to add, like, imagine everyone can see every email that everyone else sends, but no one knows who's associated with each email address. It turns out to be really hard to give analogies like this that are satisfying, but I think it can get people's foot in the door. Same with like the ledger in your checkbook, you know, the back of your checkbook. If you're old enough, you might write down every transaction that you send. The bank is doing the same thing. But now imagine that your ledger disagrees with the bank, right? You have the bank's not going to trust you. You have to trust the bank. So Bitcoin is a system where the ledgers are always matching up and everyone's always checking them. And there's a canonical agreement by everyone. So I think my favorite analogy is probably the one I alluded to earlier with Fort Knox and the security budget. Thinking about miners as Bitcoin's security force, that are, you know, a lot of people say this is wasteful. All these computations, like only one of them is needed. The one that actually finds the value. All the other ones are wasted. And the idea is, no, they're not wasted. The fact that they're happening is what deters people from attacking the network. Similarly to like people who carry a gun, if you're a good person who carries a gun, you're carrying it hoping to never need to use it. And the idea is my having this gun will prevent me from needing to use it. The security, the Secret Service at Fort Knox exists so that they never have to engage in any conflicts. And so, yeah, I don't know. I really like analogies because the Bitcoin system is so complicated. It's just that it's so multifaceted that not only are analogies tricky, they almost always fail along multiple dimensions. And so I've just gotten comfortable with that. And if people are like, yeah, but Bitcoin has a UTXO model, I'm like, yeah, I know, but like my mom doesn't care. So if I'm trying to explain it to my mom, I'm just not going to get into that.
anybody that's older than about the middle of high school lived in a world that didn't have Bitcoin. And, you know, you had to form your own mental models or preconceptions about how the world worked or didn't work. How has your study and exposure to Bitcoin changed some of your long-held beliefs about how the world worked or how it needed to work before Bitcoin existed?
I think I didn't understand much at all about how money worked. Mm-hmm. And so...
Same with most people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I talk to my students about it all the time. You know, they'll sit in some random class with me, like critical thinking or philosophy of religion. But when I introduce myself, I'm like, you know, I work on this. I also work on Bitcoin. And invariably, some of them will want to talk to me about it. And the one thing that they get really easily is that they have no privacy with respect to their transactions, right? There's headlines constantly about hacks. There's also headlines about corporations selling your data, corporations who promised that they weren't going to sell your data, selling your data, corporations using your data to target you for certain things. I still remember, this was over a decade ago, before I heard about Bitcoin, hearing about, I think it was Target, sending ads to a like 13 or 14 year old for diapers and formula. And the dad comes in furious, like, why are you sending my daughter this? She's 13 or 14 or whatever. She's not pregnant. And Target was just using people who've bought this in the past tend to buy this in the future. And it turned out she was pregnant. And they had just really accurately compiled these models of who's going to buy what and when they'll need it. So we're comfortable with the idea that we're being targeted. So we understand the mediators of our transactions using their knowledge against us in order to either sell us more things or target us in some way. But we're not super familiar with how central bank money creation works. And I'm still not. We did a workshop in Seattle with the Bitcoin Policy Institute and the American Institute for Economic Research. And we had some economists there. And especially Will Luther was like, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. This is not how it works. And that was really helpful because we had, even after doing the research, we had this sort of surface level understanding of how banking works. But it's just way more complicated than anyone but a trained economist can really understand. And Bitcoin makes that all very easy, right? You have the halving schedule. You know when the halving is going to occur. You have target block time, block size, and that's basically it. So I learned a ton about how money is created and then moves through the system. Let's see. What else was sort of paradigm breaking for me? I had heard about Operation Choke Point, but I didn't really understand just how widespread it was and how much non-legal or non-legislative influence the government can have over what happens. So there weren't laws that were passed, but there were suggestions that in order to comply with the laws, you really ought to do this. So we have anti-money laundering laws. And in order to comply with those, here's what we suggest you do. And the suggestions weren't themselves legislated. They were never voted on by representatives. They were just sort of passed on, and banks complied with them. So the amount of control that is exerted over people's lives and people's choices makes you scared. And I don't think, I mean, for a lot of people, they were affected by Operation Choke Point. A lot of people weren't, but it's not too hard to see how you might be in the future. So you're putting a whole lot of trust in future people who are in charge of the system if you don't try to either reform the system or create some things that run alongside it that you can opt out of the system for. Also, I tended to think the option was either like Bitcoin will succeed and take over all money, or Bitcoin will fail and become this really small niche thing. And I came to think that there's an option where Bitcoin is a major currency among all of the government-backed fiat currencies, and its primary role is as a discipline. So it sort of incentivizes central banks and governments to play fair, because Bitcoin is always there waiting, and it's big enough that it's easy to move into. And so if people start distrusting their central bank, they'll really quickly move everything over to Bitcoin. And so central banks aren't going to want that to happen. And that will incentivize them to, if they say create a CBDC, to make it open source and verifiably private. Otherwise nobody will use it. They'll just use Bitcoin. So yeah, those are some ways in which my thinking evolved as I started studying and writing.
Almost like a check and balance on irresponsibility in many of our existing systems. And you guys in the book, there's a really helpful piece of computing history that I wasn't aware of, that at a certain point in our computing history, you would have an IT administrator who was the de facto, you know, if anything goes wrong or if they deem that they need to change something or get into someone's account, there's someone that has the ability to get into anybody's account on an intranet. And, you know, in many ways, Bitcoin is that evolution in the world of money where you don't necessarily want someone to have unmitigated, unfettered access to your stuff, even if you trust them as sort of an administrator or caretaker of your passwords, your funds, your whatever you might have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Bitcoin removes these backdoors.
Well, as we wrap up, I'm really curious, is there anything, especially for the audience that is just getting into this, that's just kind of, you know, they figured out that Bitcoin is something important, but they're not quite sure what the downstream implications are. And I was at this point, at one point where all I cared about was price. And then, you know, the door opened to realizing how much of an impact this could have on people that I would never know or, you know, understand their background. What would your kind of main takeaway be for people that are approaching the intersection of philosophy, of Bitcoin mining? You know, how would you give them a bullet point of this is why you should care?
I think if you're in a position where the all you care about, or even the main thing that you care about, is price, then you're in a really privileged position. You're probably not too worried about your life. You're probably not too worried about your livelihood, about your savings. You're looking for something better than what you have access to, but you probably have access to some pretty good stuff already. Probably have a brokerage account, a bank account. And most of the people in the world don't have those things. They have a phone, probably, and they have cash in their local currency. Maybe they have a bank account, but they're never sure whether their bank is going to close down and steal their money. And so for them, Bitcoin is a lifeline. Now, you having some Bitcoin helps them. It helps people who are using Bitcoin as a savings vehicle to have their savings appreciate. It helps people, so transacting in Bitcoin helps people who are using Bitcoin to resist authoritarianism by flooding the blockchain with more transactions, which makes it harder for doing analytics on what's going on the blockchain. So the more you transact in Bitcoin and spend in Bitcoin and things like that, the more involved you are on the Lightning Network, the more you're helping people who are using Bitcoin as resistance money. So good job, I guess, if you're doing that. You could do that and not really be interested in who you're helping or how they're being helped or how Bitcoin is working for them. But you're participating in an anti-authoritarian network that you really should be proud of. And one of the ways of being proud of it is learning more about how people are using this money that you also have as a way of, you know, fighting for human rights and for freedom. So you should, you know, read our book. You should look up the Human Rights Foundation and their Bitcoin grants and see where their Bitcoin grants are going to. You should figure out how they're giving Bitcoin to people who are using it to fight against authoritarianism. And then you should, I mean, to the news media's credit, they have done a lot of stories about how Bitcoin is used in these ways. Now, unfortunately, the stories are as Bitcoin becomes sort of impermissible to talk about and be in favor of in polite circles. These stories are coming out less and less, but you still see them crop up, like when Ukraine was attacked. I think Newsweek ran stories about how people in Ukraine were getting money from people in the U.S. through Bitcoin and then buying their groceries locally using Bitcoin. Same with Gaza. So there are stories about how Bitcoin is being used in these ways that I think are the most important stories. And sure, it's, you know, some Americans might make more money than they otherwise would have if they just bought S&P 500 or Apple stocks or whatever. But for some people, this is really life-saving, life-changing digital cash. So that's what I'm in it for. That's what Andrew and Craig are in it for. And it's good that, so I mean, one of the ingenious things about this multifaceted approach to Bitcoin is that people owning Bitcoin in the US as a speculative investment is actually helping people in other countries to resist authoritarianism. And I think that's kind of cool.
I love it. Man, anybody who is a thinking person or knows a thinking person in their lives, they should definitely pick up the book. Resistance Money is a fantastic read. Is there anywhere else that you'd like us to point listeners to keep up with what you're working on? Any way that they can connect with you on social media, for example? Where can our audience find what you're working on and doing in the world?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, at RettlerB, RettlerB. If you're interested in the academic research on Bitcoin, the Bitcoin Research Institute is just getting started. We launched it during the Bitcoin conference in Nashville. And the goal is to have a newsletter that comes out every month or two that sort of draws attention to the best new papers on Bitcoin published by academics, and also the worst ones, the ones that seem like they have the potential to be influential but get something wrong. And so that's at uwyo.edu/Bitcoin. And Andrew Bailey, one of my co-authors on the book, is going to be moving to Wyoming in the next fall. And we're really going to hit the ground running when he gets here.
Love it.
So that's it.
Very cool. I love the work that you guys are doing. I really appreciate the approach that you've taken in the book and the way that you speak about this important revolution that we've got going on in our world. I think we're all so lucky to get to live through it. It's such a cool time to be alive and just watch the impacts, watch the downstream implications. But I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming and sharing your knowledge with our audience and just sharing your perspective. It's very refreshing when people, especially people who have spent so much time in this, can take a very balanced and as close as we can get to a non-biased approach of how to examine this technology and keep us fresh for the people in our lives that we're trying to not shill this to, but really help them understand what it is in a way that they can appreciate, in a way that they can accept. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing, Brad, and thank you for sharing yourself with our listeners.
Ah, thanks, Bo. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.